Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. My name is Don Allen in Studio A, and over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Actually, good evening, Don. I am absolutely fine and just watching the merry-go-round go around. I was just pointing out to my colleague just before, seconds before we went on the air, headline in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder of last week talking about disparities. Civil rights report, some kind of civil rights report from somebody, indicating that, it's from our friend Miss Levy Pounds. You remember her, Don. Civil rights report highlights across-the-board disparities, educational gaps, high incarceration, strongly impacts black unemployment. I didn't know that black folks were unemployed in Minnesota. Every report I see says that we're just at the top of the grade. Things are just going absolutely well for us.
Yeah, we're all down at the stadium and everything, you know, making that 65, 45, whatever dollars they make per hour down there, working them 60-hour weeks. Yeah, it's just, you know.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But also, I just want to send out a shout-out to Lucky Rosenblum. If he's tuned in yet, he had an article in, last week's edition, Spokesman Recorder, calling upon American black leadership here in the Twin Cities to support our Somali brothers and sisters, and I'm not quite sure what support is needed, because every time I look around, I see a number of our African-American leaders with Somali principles and et cetera. So, you know, Lucky, if you're out there, homie, give us a call. You know, bring us up to speed. Don, give that phone number right quick, and then I understand we got a call.
Yes. That phone number is 347-426-3904, 347-426-3904. But that caller, I just spoke with them. They're going to hold for a second until we get to that section. So I appreciate you, caller, being there. Just stand by. We will get to you.
All right.
The engineer has identified someone who that is, and we understand that, and we'll be right with you. But anyway, Mr. Edwards, you know, in the production meeting, we're talking about this this big move to by the West Broadway Business Area Coalition and Mr. Tim Baylor, who owns the McDonald under Pinnacle Management, LLC, to develop West Broadway from Aldrich Avenue all the way over to Emerson Avenue. And if you recall, for those listening and locally here that remember this, this is the same gentleman who his company and built the apartment back there where the Riverview used to be. And
The Riverview apartments.
Just
down the road from the Park Board's beautiful headquarters there, overlooking the beautiful Mississippi. Tim's going to be doing some development along Broadway from Aldrich to Emerson. Is that right? Boy, he must have a lot of buyout money.
They're having a meeting Tuesday, March 18th from 5 from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. at his McDonald's on 916 West Broadway. They will hear from Pinnacle Management, LLC, about potential redevelopment of the south side of West Broadway from Aldrich to Emerson Avenues. And, you know, on that street, Mr. Edwards, there's a record store. There's a couple other things there. The late Dennis, Dr. Williams' office, the Hennepin County.
UN banks there where people go to get their checks and things cash. Yeah.
Neon, there's a couple of private grocery stores, you know. The record store there.
Hair salons, a couple of hair salons.
Yes, there is. And then back towards
Aldridge and Cub is a couple of big buildings there that Enterprise is in there. And then as you go up to Emerson, you've got the former First Bank building there on that side of the street. Well, that's going to call for a lot of demolition and buying up a property. And then I don't know how much of that is actually owned by the Archdiocese, because I don't know how far back you're going to go towards what would it be, 19th, because that's all Archdiocese territory back there.
Yep. They own a lot of them. They have houses.
Oh, yes. The Archdiocese? Oh, yes. They control a lot of property. Yes.
Yeah, I'm actually getting the engineer, Mr. Edward, to pull me up a picture online of that particular area there. Street view, here we go. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I already have mine here in studio. Yes,
yeah,
sir.
I'm looking. I have a summertime shot, and I'm actually traveling west on West Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And I am now in front of the building on the left that I think used to be a car dealership that's right next to the McBurger.
Way
team.
Back in the day. That's right.
Way
that's
back
right.
In, yeah,
used to be a White Castle
day.
There, too, across
yep.
the street. But we're talking
so.
About the same side of the street where Cubs is located.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm gonna, I'm actually turning around here. Yes, and you're looking at the prayer center, which is not there anymore. There's a cell phone store, and this is a rather old picture, actually. But if I keep going down the street here, I am going to – let me just – oh, wow. This thing is so
at
graphic.
At one time, the Olympic Cafe was there, but they since moved up next to Ackerberg's property there where the Urban Contemporary radio station is located.
Okay.
The place where they were supposed to go, there was going to be an Applebee's, you remember, and then another place, but none of that seemed to measure out.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, okay. Well,
yeah,
that's a lot of property that's still active, and Mr. Baylor is going to kind of give us a state of development message or the community. This comes on the heels of the announcement of affordable, equitable housing along Penn and Golden Valley Road, right? Across
yes,
the street
yes.
from the notorious convenience store. And that's going to include housing and a youth recreation center,
mm-hmm.
which I'm a little puzzled because we already have two youth recreation centers, if you will, YM and YW, within a block and a half, but, you know, North Commons and then... But anyways, a lot of development going on, a lot of development, I understand.
Yes, mm-hmm. there is. Yes, there is. Yes, there is, Mr. Edwards. Yeah, and moving right along here, I had got a call, Mr. Edwards, Saturday night, Sunday night, and Monday night about a sad and hurtful thing, the funeral of the five Lewis children. And that were
oh, yes, yes,
caught in
yes.
that inferno. And first of all, before we go on, you know, I'd just like to send our condolences out to the Lewis family and Mr. Lewis. And you know, and under news, there are some things that we have to look at because we continue to stay in our lane and do our job. And
absolutely.
When people let things slip, you know, I think it's our responsibility as journalists to address these things. And we have some troubling things about that funeral and what took place in Bishop Howell's Church, Shiloh International Ministries on Broadway Avenue. And so I'm a little bit, you know, I'm in awe from the political tomfoolery that was going on from, I didn't go, let's get it straight right now. I would not, I don't want to see any babies getting buried. And so I chose not to go to this, this funeral service, but
because you have two very young children yourself,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Allen. I mean, for that purpose. By the way, just for you know, as pertains to you know, speaking out of the tragedy, my column in the Spokesman Recorder last week, you know, raised questions about corruption and bribery, and how an attempt was being made by certain elements and forces, even in North Minneapolis, to blame the father. For the
mm-hmm.
tragic death of five of his seven children, if you will. And we, you know, we've encouraged folks who haven't maybe read the article in the Spokesman Recorder of last week, welcome to take a look at it. We raised questions with respect to inspections and et cetera by the city of Minneapolis
mm-hmm.
and, you know, misrepresentations by the owner, Mission Inn Incorporated, if you will, about what they had actually provided. But, again, that's a story within itself, but it is in the Spokesman Recorder, so and, you know, so they didn't, no one gets into, well, what have you guys done, what have you guys said. So continue on, because we have a caller on this particular
yes.
matter about
yes.
the services.
And,
go right ahead.
Yeah, and I thought, Mr. Edwards, it's important that we bring somebody in that was actually there, because, you know, sometimes when they, you know, they call us Heckle and Jekyll. And so
it's
good for us to bring someone in that was there that, you know, is an individual thinker and thinks for their own self and notice this stuff. So it kind of validates what we've been saying here for the last few years on Blog Talk Radio and in our separate news agencies that, you know, there's some political puffery by the DFL political plantation that needs to be shut down altogether. And I'm going to go to the caller and see if the caller...
Okay, welcome our caller aboard.
Welcome. Are you there?
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and you don't have to say your name if you don't want to. That's fine, but I understand that you attended the services on Saturday, and I don't want to lead you in any direction, but just can you give us an overview, and maybe we'll ask you some questions, but just go ahead and give us an overview of what was going on that just put a foul taste in folks' minds and mouths and attitudes. Go ahead, please.
First and foremost, I've never attended a funeral that was orchestrated or however they, you want to put the word on it. It was the five children, and as a mother, it was just crazy. It was like there was the order, the things that were done that wasn't in order. And how can you go, you're giving out a program to, I was a greeter, I actually volunteered as a greeter, mm-hmm. And as everyone went in, they got a program for the funeral. And as I looked over the program, as they started, you know, everybody got seated or whatever, a lot of the teachers showed up, the principal, everyone was seated. They had the politician section, the media section, and the family, and the teachers. And my thing with that was all of a sudden I'm looking, the program has been rearranged. And it, to me, it was like it wasn't a funeral. The only person that I heard really talking about the kids was the aunt.
Mm-hmm.
When I tell you, these are five precious little babies. And
yeah.
The agendas, I felt like, and I, they don't know me. I'm just a Northside resident. But I've been, you know, I'm always looking to see how things go, and I'm new. I've just been back to Minnesota 2.5 years, so I'm hearing all the, you know, about our leaders on the north side. So I'm feeling like this should have been a event for the kids, not an event, but the funeral, the you know, recognizing the kids. They lost their lives. A father lost 5 kids,
and it wasn't about them. Okay, well, let me ask you right there, if it wasn't about the 5 children laying in these little caskets in front of the church, a sad, I mean, I hate to even vision it, but, you know, what was it about? I mean, how could it be about
anything
else?
I'm going to be straight and honest with you.
I appreciate that.
It just wasn't myself, but I'm going to speak for me.
Okay.
As a community activist and advocate, I felt it was political from the pulpit, for not all, but people were orchestrating what they wanted to do and had whom they wanted to speak. A lot of the things that were done, how do you let the mayor walk in? And she was kind of taken aback because they had her doing the benediction.
Wait, hold up. You mean at the end of the service, the mayor
yes.
of Minneapolis, Betsy Hodges Cunningham, got up and did the benediction at a funeral?
She was invited up by the Bishop Howell, and I know the protocol for benedictions. I've been to a lot of funerals, and everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
But and it was just so out of order to me. So I'm sure other people thought it. Some people said it, but you know what I mean? Some people don't like to cause problems. I'm not trying to cause problems. I'm trying to raise awareness of we have leaders in the community, and how can you expect our community to be acting right if you're not acting right?
But
exactly.
Let me just also cut in with a question. Of course, I've heard from individuals about their perception of what was happening, and it isn't far off from what you're saying. I have to ask this question because we also have an international audience. We have people listening in India and England, Africa, Mexico, you know, even the Ukraine. But explain what you mean when you say the protocol, because the mayor, if I'm like Mr. Allen, the mayor did the benediction.
I am shocked.
Yes. And she was kind of shocked, too, because, you know, she kind of hesitated because I'm sure she knew that someone, you know, a pastor or someone on the podium there should have been speaking it, saying it. But the other downside to that was the teachers were there that had worked with these kids, knew them, helped them, helping them when their mother passed. The principal, no one was allowed, wasn't even called to speak. And I felt that was, you know, just not right, a disservice to them because they were out, you know, besides raising money, they really cared about the kids.
Now, let me get a better understanding of that also. I would have thought that the teachers, who certainly both educated, nurtured, and et cetera, two of the deceased babies, would have been called to talk in terms of the precious moments that they knew and enjoyed with respect to these two children. You mean no teacher's representative was asked to speak to the gathering, to the congregation?
No, and they were there. I mean, they showed up for, you know.
They took up two whole roles, I understand.
Yes, they did not speak at all. They were allowed sitting up front, but they did not speak. The principal was there. I saw the majority of them come in. They were really there for the kids, and you could tell, you know, you can feel someone's passion, and, you know, they were hurting, too, because I work around people and I, you know, do different things. But my thing with that, on top of all of that, I'm looking for a service that was really going to be a touching tribute to the kids. And, you know, it was about, to me, the grown folks that had their agenda, whatever you want to call it.
I understand there were quite a few introductions at the political leaders and the such, like superintendent of schools, one of our state representatives, people like that were. Now, let me ask this question, because I've heard some criticism, and I wasn't there. I was not in attendance. I'm like Mr. Allen. Now, after people were introduced, they stayed for the entire services, didn't they?
Some of them did.
I heard a terrible rumor that some folks, you know, after they were introduced and they were acknowledged as being present politically and otherwise, they slipped out the side door. I mean, that wasn't
happening. Yes, that's true. Yes, some of them did.
Oh,
yes, and on top of that, I'm gonna just throw this out to our community. We should have had that church should have been overflowing with just people in general. And when I heard, and I saw for myself, because I kept expecting people to keep coming in. You know, when you are ahead of something, I'm gonna make sure I got all my people there, people from other churches, whatever. The clergy showed up, but I didn't see a whole lot of their people. But when I got home, the newsman actually said, "Oh, it was 200 people."
Yeah, I mean,
and
was that
kind of
accurate or
me.
Not accurate?
Was it could have been. Yeah, it wasn't. The church wasn't full, and that's a large church.
Very large, very large. I think it seats probably 1,500 in the entire chapel there, what we would call the chapel.
Exactly.
Let me ask this question also. As journalists, I mean, we're obligated to, you know, ask these questions. You talked at the very beginning about that you acted as a volunteer usher and were showing people. And so part of that, you would be handing out the program, right, for the services.
Yes.
Now, is it correct what I have been told that the mayor of our city, who wound up doing the eulogy, was not on the original program?
Not that I saw.
Okay,
unless
so
they wrote
you did not
it
see her.
I didn't see her. No.
I see.
No.
So she arrived. And the reason I was saying that, I knew that she was at a political convention, Mr. Allen, somewhere else in the city, and you know, maybe
and
our itinerary was.
She actually showed up a little late because I actually greeted her because, you know, I know her. And when she came in, I think the service had started, and then the usher took her down to wherever she was sitting.
Okay, but she was not on the official formal program.
No.
I
they
oh, okay.
they kind of changed the program. That's what the other craziness was.
And changed it from what to what?
You know, just shifting people around. That they, you know, it was like you had a program that was printed a day or two before, and everybody that was in charge, the churches, the everybody knew who was going to do what. Mm-hmm. Now, when you go hand out a program, and you looking like, well, what happened? They changed the youth person that was supposed to be, I think he was supposed to introduce the teachers or somebody or something like that with the kids. You know, it should have been about the kids that were there. That they did have a little band, which was good. I think someone talked to the little band of kids being there. And actually, the other part was another lady that I know the day before went out and made the butterfly things. They mentioned those on the TV and in the news about the poster board with the pictures on it. And then she also went out and bought the frames for the pictures. And my other thing was that they didn't have a whole lot of flowers. I don't care what type of service they were going to have.
They didn't have a whole lot of flowers? That's interesting.
No.
I
the
see.
Pulpit was full of how they normally have theirs, but my thing was the disservice to this family was if it had been me, I think I would have just stopped it and said, hold up, wait a minute. That's the kind of person, I believe in everything being right, and you know, and we all being on one accord, but when you got people going this way, pulling this, it was a hot mess. And people knew it. And I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not a negative person, but I believe in right. And when you're a Christian, I am one involved in the church in a lot of different ways. And I know what's right and what's not.
Okay. All right, my sister. Mr. Allen, you have anything else?
It's really sad.
I was
maybe thinking, you know, earlier you said that some of these people, after they introduced, you know, ducked out the door. And we do have to leave room because they could have just been overwhelmed with grief and just couldn't stay there any longer.
No.
So, that wasn't the case?
No, that wasn't the case. That was the quietest funeral I ever, you know, attended. And if it's by a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? It was just the feeling wasn't there, the energy. That funeral, you can go to a funeral, it's to celebrate the ones that are passed and to help the family to grieve and you know, have a good feeling about they're okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen. I think they didn't do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Well,
okay. All right. We appreciate your due diligence and your passion, because I can already hear it in your voice. We certainly appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And if you want to listen, I will put you in the queue so you can listen to the rest of the show. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
So, Mr. Edwards, can I ask you a question about this? Now, we know that
if I can answer,
I mean, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but. You know, so we have this situation where Mr. Lewis wants Reverend Jerry McAfee to do the eulogy for the children, and then we have the church that is ran by Bishop Howe from Shiloh International Ministries. And this is, you know, as I hear, you know, this wasn't the first story I heard, but as more as I get calls I get and I hear about this, I mean, this might have been a battle of penis envy between Bishop Howell and Reverend McAfee, you know, for position.
Oh, my God, I would hope not, because it wasn't about them or their church. It was about these five babies and their surviving heirs, if you will, their father and their two sisters. I mean, wow, I didn't think. But, you know, I have to say, Mr. Allen, you know, for a week leading up to the internment, if you will, I was hearing that at first it was going to be at New Salem, and then decisions were being made that wasn't the place to have it, that some political types were not comfortable in being at New Salem, and so it was shifted to Reverend House, Bishop House, I'm sorry, Bishop House Church. And then on Thursday, the Thursday before the Saturday service, the TV stations, and this is for folks that are saying that, you know, that Donnie and Ronnie, Jekyll and Hyde are negative and et cetera, announced that the service was going to be at New Salem. That would be the church of the Reverend Jerry McAfee. And then by midday Friday, people were saying, no, that's not what it is. You people don't know what you're talking about. And then some kind of announcement said it was going to be at Shiloh, an international ministry. So it was quite clear that there was something going on, and it had to do with making sure that other folks were comfortable. Though, if you remember, Reverend McAfee on Thursday, before the actually had press conference, he facilitated a press conference at his church, New Salem, with the father, with
Incredible.
Lewis.
Incredible. The talent of that guy. Wow. Okay. And what was the press conference about?
Well, the press conference was for Mr. Lewis to kind of thank the community for its caring and you know, compassion and et cetera, but also to indicate that he would continue to pursue an examination of the conditions pertaining to the duplex that he lived in, in which five of his children lost their lives. And that apparently was needed because there were some nasty allegations and rumors going out and around about Mr. Lewis, which seemed to have no foundation or basis whatsoever. So anyways, that press conference was called, and that's when the TV stations indicated that, and oh yes, by the way, services will be here at New Salem on Saturday. So what, something happened, and it clearly didn't happen, if you will, and I just don't know. You know, I did not realize, though some of the people that have talked to me, you know, were talking in terms of who kind of did what, but, you know, I didn't realize that none of the teachers were invited to come to the dais, if you will, and talk in terms of their memory and recollection of these children. I thought that at least one of them, because I understand that every teacher at Bethune attended the funeral.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. You know, maybe it's such a sensitive area, but I'm just not understanding. I hope that things weren't being facilitated to make politicians comfortable.
Well, I just got a text here from a Shauna. I don't know who this is. It came through the switchboard here, and it reads that you might want to check and see if the gas and water was on at Shiloh that weekend. She says you might want to check.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I thought you were getting ready to say, somebody was going to say, was the heat and gas on at the home? Was the heat and gas on at Shiloh? Well, Shiloh is wealthiest church in the black ecumenical community,
you know,
right?
And you know what? She corrected it. I just have another text from her. She says, I'm sorry, I meant New Salem.
Oh, my God.
Is that right? And again, to our listeners.
Well, I don't, you know, I have no independent knowledge of anything like that, but anyone who is a member of New Salem, including the Reverend Jerry McAfee, I mean, we encourage them to welcome to call in and clear, because that's a pretty deep stab, if you will. I mean, to imply that church, because if I'm not mistaken, I heard some people talking in terms of services there the following day, and also services there the prior week when they raised, oh, I don't know, about $1,400 of cash to be given to the father, which was given to him that Monday. In other words, the Monday before the Saturday funeral. But I don't know. I don't know what to say, Mr. Allen. I want to stay on my side of the highway on something like that.
Yeah, yeah, me too, exactly.
Yeah, wow. Was the gas and heat on? Yeah. Okay.
Well, I guess the moral of this, and moving on, I guess the moral of this is that maybe I was almost getting ready to call Bishop Howell's cell phone. But the moral of this is maybe, you know, that Mayor Hollier shouldn't be doing the benediction at any future funerals for anybody. And we'll just put it like
you know,
that.
Particularly when she was not on the original agenda or itinerary or program, specifically mm-hmm. within our Black ecumenical culture, the program. I've heard a number of people have spoken to me about the fact that it was quite obvious as the caller who certainly stood up and spoke to the proposition that the mayor seemed to be most uncomfortable with regards to what she was called upon to do, you know. But I don't know, maybe folks will say that they knew she was coming, knew she was going to be running late, coming from the political activities involving the Democratic Party. I just don't know. Well, what else do we have, Mr. Allen?
Well, I know that the Minneapolis police is happening too. Yeah, we got to talk about the Minneapolis police and this this weapon, Mr. Edwards, that you alerted me to in the production meeting, and the story in the Star and Tribune for tomorrow morning.
Yes, you know, this is also very peculiar, and there's so much other things, and we've got, you know, a real hot portion of programming tonight,
mm-hmm.
and we are going an hour and a half. A news conference was called this morning at City Hall in the Minneapolis Police Department, MPD. Deputy chief, not even the chief or the assistant chief. The assistant chief is Assistant Chief Clark, and, of course, the chief is Chief Janae Harto. But it was a deputy chief, Chris Arneson, who handled the press conference. And that was kind of puzzling to me because when you talk in terms of the press conference being called and the announcement and et cetera, you would think that the highest-ranking officer in the department, or if not her significant principal, which is the assistant chief, would be the one to do it. But, you know, they do whatever they want to do. But the purpose of the press conference was to announce that the DNA of the late Terrence Franklin had been found on a sock which contained a gun, which was under a house some short distance allegedly away from the place in which he lost his life back on May 10th, 2013. Now, people would immediately ask the question, and I saw it during most of the day, well, you know, what's the significance of it, and et cetera. Well, the significance is that by saying that they found an old rusty gun, and I got to tell you, Mr. Allen, you know, you and I are both members of the, you know, Rifle Association, such things as that. When I see a you know, well-designed, high-priced weapon such as the Desert Eagle, looking as rusty as that gun looked, and that gun looked like it had been at the bottom of a lake somewhere for 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the gun was allegedly put in a sock, and they're maintaining that the DNA on the sock was Mr. Franklin's.
Mm-hmm.
And the relevance in this regard would be that the gun was allegedly stolen in northeast Minneapolis in a home burglary on May 9th, 2013, which would have been the day before Mr. Franklin lost his life, being shot 10 times by Minneapolis police officers in a basement on Bryant after hand-to-hand combat, according to. And we welcome anyone to go back on demand and listen to our programs starting on May 10th, 2013. But the presence, allegedly, of Mr. Franklin's DNA on the sock, which would allegedly means that he was involved in the theft of this rusty gun from a private home in northeast Minneapolis. That's what tomorrow morning's edition of the Star Tribune under the byline of Matt McKinney will say. So it's not anything we're editorializing on. We're talking in terms mm-hmm. of what will be in the paper, which is already online. But the purpose of this is disturbing, certainly to the attorney, a Mr. Michael Patton, who has handled a couple of high-profile cases, if you will, And we've had him on these programs three or four times, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
Mr. Allen,
yes,
over the last couple of years. But the purpose is that this continues to malign the reputation and memory of the deceased, Mr. Franklin. It portrays him as a home invader, burglar, you know, general thug, and all those kinds of things. And this becomes extremely important to the city because Mr. Patton has indicated on behalf of the heirs and the family of the late Mr. Franklin that he, Mr. Patton, will be filing a civil suit. They, you know, they lost the criminal suit, per se. County attorney did just a beautiful job of making sure an absence of information got to the grand jury, so they returned no bill. I've been asked a couple times today, well, what is the relevance? Well, the relevance is that this makes it more difficult to present a unbiased picture in support of Mr. Franklin's reputation. And let me tell you one of the prime features, and I know some of our legal friends out there, Mr. Allen, will appreciate this, and certainly some of the professors of law and et cetera at your institution over there. One of the things that never happened in the grand jury, and one of the things that was never even really publicly talked about other than on this program back in May and June, et cetera, is that the police officers were never questioned about their state of mind when they came down those stairs. Okay? They had allegedly chased Mr. Franklin into that house on Bryant 28th and Bryant, 2800 block, Bryant Avenue South, South Minneapolis. And they were never asked about their state of mind. And this became critical when the city realized that the family was going to push ahead with a civil lawsuit, asking for significant damages and et cetera, because the absence of questioning the officers on their state of mind does not allow you to deal with some misinformation that initially was put out in the first 20 minutes or so of the so-called 90-minute chase, and that was that Mr. Franklin was allegedly seen with a gun. Mm-hmm. After he had fled from the automobile that he had been driving, if you will, the PE Cruiser. Now, the legal community knows that if you put a person, an officer, police officers, anybody else who has been involved in the taking of a life, and you put them on the stand and you're able to examine them without significant opposition from the opposing attorneys and the judge, and I saw this happen, unfortunately, in the Fong Lee case a couple years ago. But if you're able to kind of stretch people out on the issue of your state of mind as you came down the stairs, then it could possibly carry significant weight in the final arguments and with the jury, okay? And what the attorneys and legal experts for the city realize is that they never advanced that, Mr. Allen, the whole issue of state of mind, because they knew the grand jury situation was a fix, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the civil case will not be that unless the court throws out the lawsuit and the motions that Mr. Patton is going to be making for the family, I assume, okay? So you get an officer up on the stand and you start talking about his state of mind. Well, what should have been crafted, Mr. Allen, was a establishment of a state of mind doctrine with regards to those police officers who went into that basement and shot 10 times, blew Mr. Franklin away, because they should have been conditioned to have said that their state of mind was that this Negro hiding in the basement was armed. Are you following, Mr. Allen?
Yep.
Okay. And so their state of mind was, as they ascended down the stairs and realized that he was concealing himself and et cetera, they were certainly concerned about him opening fire on them, because there had been a statement and declarations made in the first 20 minutes of the chase that he was armed. And then they appeared to back off of that. But anyways, you're coming down the stairs. You ultimately, the dog, remember the dog? That was so important.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the dog, that the dog sought and found Mr. Franklin and began to pull him by, you know, grabbing him in the groin area and et cetera, where, you know, doggies are trained to, you know, quote-unquote attack, if you will. Now, the dog pulls him out, and the officers then began to beat him, and then they shoot him, okay? Of course, he apparently got his hands on the MP5. Tomorrow morning's edition of the paper and what's online already basically will say once again that the MP4 under the control of a SWAT team officer, highly trained, decorated and all that, was on single shot, okay? Now, later on, 5 months later, this officer was identified as being one of the most courageous officers you wanted to see because even after he was shot in the leg, he joined Officer Luke Peterson in opening fire on Mr. Franklin, shooting him at least 8 times, though the coroner said he was shot 10 times. And that's in the morning paper tomorrow also, maybe a slight slip-up. So it is the whole issue of state of mind. And so what has been established now by finding this gun, which, by the way, has been over in the crime laboratory since the 28th day of October 2013, which means also it was the porch at this person's home, the gentleman who found it, who, by the way, in tomorrow morning's edition of the paper, indicated he did not want to be named, though you know where he lives because his house, aerial shots of his house are up on the police websites. So what has now been established is it will help the officers as it pertains to their state of mind as they came down the stairs following their canine who had been sent into the basement to, quote-unquote, seek out this young African-American. And the dog and the African-American were in some kind of combat. Now, you got to be careful about this because you don't want to ask the officers the wrong question about state of mind because if they elaborate too much about, well, we knew that the Negro was armed, then you would have to ask yourself, well, okay, I mean, we know that things are moving quickly and decisively and et cetera, but if he was armed, don't you think he would have opened fire on the dog, right?
Yeah.
So, but we'll be able to set that aside, okay? But by establishing that this gun that allegedly was taken in a burglary in northeast Minneapolis on the 9th of May, according to what the story and everything that was released today says, that it was Mr. Franklin, who is just on a burglary binge, if you will, just burglarizing and breaking into people's houses and et cetera. Now, the thing, like I said, is puzzling, Mr. Allen, and you've had weapons training and et cetera, and we have pictures of it in our, as we look at our computers in studio, correct? You have yours up?
Yes, I do.
I mean, that gun, and first of all, it's an automatic, and that gun is so rusty, I doubt that you could pull it back to move a shell casing into the chamber. Now, what is your observation on that particular statement by me just
well,
now?
Yeah, well, I agree 100%. I'm looking at a 9mm Desert Eagle, which was one of the standard issue guns to officers during Desert Storm. It's a popular weapon for infantrymen. 11 Bravo in the military army. And I'm looking at this weapon, and I am seeing, you know, I don't think this was Terrence Franklin's weapon. I don't think there's a pin in there. I think that this was one of those throwdowns that they find and somehow appears somewhere, on, you know, and they can make it. I don't see how they made the connection. But, yeah, just looking at the weapon, it doesn't look like it will fire. It's like it's old, rusty, and yeah, there's some history there, but it's not with Terrence Franklin.
Now, the reason I asked that question, Mr. Allen, is because some people are confused. They watch too many of these television programs, crime programs. People think that you can lift 99% of the time fingerprints off of a weapon. In fact, actually, the article tomorrow also will point out what I've known for a long time as a monitor for the Department of Justice, that maybe about 12% of the time are you able to lift a fingerprint off a weapon. Now, you're able to lift DNA, but because this gun had been out in the elements from May 10th until October 28th of 2013, you know, you had rain, you know, you had wind, you had dust, you had any and everything, even though it was allegedly wedged. Notice the word we use, wedged, and that will be the word used by the Star Tribune in tomorrow morning's edition of the paper. In between the porch and the foundation of the house, which is interesting also because all news accounts, and Mr. Allen and I during the production meeting went back and took a look at all the stories that were written within hours and TV broadcasts and et cetera, and we were being told, with the exception of Mr. Franklin stopping and making a telephone call from the bike shop, he was quote-unquote on the run with police on his tail. You know what I'm saying? Though they lost track of him when he allegedly broke in to the house at 28th and Bryant, where he later was to lose his life. So the sock thing now begins to make more sense because you have an item, if you will, black sock, in which you will be able to indicate that. And I'm trying to figure out, by the way, when, because they said it was blood, right? You pulled it up in studio there, correct? You have it in front of you, as I do.
Yes, I do.
They said blood, and so I'm trying to wonder at what point was he hurt in the automobile accident? Was he cut or et cetera that made him bleed on the sock on the 10th day of May 2013? I'm not sure where the blood, but the blood is the firmest of forensic evidence when you start talking about DNA, okay? Boy, if you can get, you know, I mean, you know, sweat and skin fluff and et cetera, but boy, if you can get the blood, if you can get the blood of the suspect, I mean, that's pretty tough for anybody, you know, to refute coming in as a witness for the deceased. So I'm trying to figure out also at what point was he injured to the extent that he bled on this sock, which contained, and by the way, Mr. Allen, you have the data there. The size of a Desert Eagle is about what?
It's a nice weapon. It's a nice size weapon. It's I can't. Let me just. You know what? Since I'm sitting here right in front, I have the other computer on. Let's just look it up here. Give me 1 second here.
I think it's close to 12 inches in length. It's a very bulky weapon. It's not like the traditional, well, let's say, 380 or snub-nose 22 or snub-nose 32 or a 35 or a 25 caliber. It's about a 12-inch weapon and thick, if you will, in mass. See, and that's the other thing is, man, to have been able to even gotten that in the sock. You know what I mean? But, hey, it's not for us. Certainly to question, if you will, but still the authorities, after extensive examination in the crime laboratory, the same crime laboratory, by the way, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which did such an excellent job of finding all of Mr. Franklin's DNA on the nozzle and the trigger of the MP4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyways, that is part of what will be happening, and I don't want to continue to belabor it because we have some other news that is also extremely important, but I think it is so tragic what is being done to malign this young man, to create additional pressure and embarrassment for his family to that extent, but more importantly, to obstruct and interfere with the civil case.
Wow, yeah. I mean, I agree with you 100%. I'm just looking at here the desert. That's a nice weapon. That is a nice weapon.
And the one that the Star Tribune is showing, I mean, you don't know where they got that from, the police, you know. And to stick it in a sock while he's running and get blood on it, come on, there's a lot of explaining. The last three paragraphs of the Star Tribune story, Mr. Edwards, are very interesting. Because I feel that I need to like read this out loud so you can analyze.
Go ahead, Mr. Allen. I'll follow you.
Okay, it says, this is like the last three or four paragraphs of the story. It explains the turn of events. He then parked the car and ran on foot as officers began shutting down portions of the neighborhood near Lindale Avenue South, Franklin, and broke in near Lindale Avenue South, period. Franklin broke into a house on the 27th block of Bryant Avenue South, where he was later discovered by officers investigating the home's broken rear window. A police dog sent into the home's basement found Franklin hiding behind a water heater in the cramped and darkened basement. A police account said Franklin lunged at the officers when he was eventually pulled from his hiding space. He briefly took control of an MP5 machine pistol that was strapped to the chest of one of the officers. Franklin fired twice, striking the officers Ricardo Muro and Michael Meath in the legs. They both survived. DNA analysis later showed Franklin touched the trigger of the MP5, according to sources close to the investigation.
Well, I certainly would have had to have shot it twice. And keep in mind that the report, the grand jury report and the final report, 200 and some page report issued by the Manhattan Police Department in the late fall would go on to indicate that there was also blood, even maybe down on the nozzle, if you will, which is interesting because it was fascinating for Mr. Franklin to be able to control that weapon. And by the way, that same officer was, though shot and certainly disoriented to some degree, was able to fire four times while his colleague, Luke Peterson, was actually in hand-to-hand combat with Mr. Franklin. As he shot him four times, this officer, who had already been shot, was able from a distance of about 8 to 9 feet in a darkened basement, was able to fire, hitting Mr. Franklin four times. That's eight. But the coroner, in issuing his declaration of cause of death, indicated Mr. Franklin had been shot 10 times, which means that some other officer down there also fired off two shots. And it was fascinating when you go back and read the descriptions and the information that was being leaked in May and particularly June and some parts of July about the hand-to-hand combat, the fierce battling was going on, and et cetera, that officers would open fire in that close proximity to their own comrade. But anyways, and of course the phone lines are always open for anyone that may have any question of our analysis.
And Mr. Edwards, I just would like to say that Ricochet is a son of a bitch on concrete floors in them South Minneapolis houses. You know?
Yeah, you're not suggesting as we did. And we, by the way, we encourage listeners to go on demand and listen to our programs of May 11th, 18th, and 25th.
Mm-hmm.
Our programs of those particular dates, the 11th, the 18th, and the 25th. We would encourage you to listen and give us a call and at some point in time over the next weeks and examine us on some of the things that we said long before the official investigation began. But go ahead, Mr. Allen.
Yeah. I find it hard. You know, remember I told you last year, Mr. Edwards, I talked to a forensics professor who used to work for the BCA, actually. And, and I explained to him from a layman's point of view, because I am not a forensics expert, but I told him, I said, take into account that I am not a forensics expert, but let me run this down to you. I'm in the basement. There's 3 to 5 police officers with weapons, okay?
Five
police officers with weapons in this basement, okay? They are whooping my ass, okay? I am shot
in the armpit, in the back, and a head shot. Okay? A few times. 10 times.
Let's be clear on the head shots, and let's also be clear on the shot that was allegedly in the back. It was more to the front. The shots to the head were all in the front, blowing off the entire left side of his face, starting from his ear around to his nose. Okay?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah, from his ear around to his nose. Yeah.
Well, there are accounts, Mr. Edwards, that his he was shot to like near the underarm area, you know, near his underarms. And, well, this forensic professor says, well, he had his hands in the air.
Which absolutely, to have received the shot
under
the armpit, his arm certainly had to be up to the extent that you had a clear shot to shoot him under the armpit. Yes, sir. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so
the
guy just shook his head. He shook his head. He says, I don't understand this. You know, this is like physically even for if there's five cops in there, police officers, whoever they call themselves. And
oh, these are police officers, SWAT team members, highly trained, highly elite. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and some individual, some perp, lunges at your weapon. There's no possible way that your weapon is even the safety is off. The safety is on until you get ready to use that weapon. They were not in any immediate threat where they would have the safety not would have the safety off to use the MP5 when they have other sidearms like Glocks, 9mm, whatever, you know, all kinds.
Well, they also have tasers.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but let me just say one of the things that you're missing, my colleague from the right. You have to understand that Mr. Franklin was at basically all points in time until the dog was pulled away as they shot him to death. That Mr. Franklin was being controlled by a police dog that weighs a little over 100 pounds. See, no one is. See, the initial reports and et cetera, particularly when they were doing their debriefing in room 108 down at City Hall and et cetera, that dog was sent in and was actually pulling Mr. Franklin out from behind, quote unquote, the sink, if you will. And Mr. Franklin, was in great pain and discomfort because the dog had him in the groin. In fact, the dog tore some of his testicles during the course of pulling him out. So he was, you know, in great discomfort and et cetera. Also, one of the things that, you know, they haven't talked about, they were pulling on, because the young man had dreadlocks, they were pulling on his dreadlocks so hard that they actually pulled a couple of them out of his head.
Mm.
And that would make sense because they were pulling him by the hair. They were also hitting him in the head with those big flashlights that they use. And actually, at some point, Mr. Allen, he became unconscious before they blew his head apart.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And you're correct on the thing about ricochets. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And by the way, a medical physician in a ER emergency room or a forensic expert could tell you if, in fact, a bullet has actually hit soft flesh and bones or if it first hit concrete, cement, and then ricocheted into a person's body, okay? In this case, ricocheted into somebody's leg, not Mr. Franklin's, by the way.
Exactly.
But, you know, that information and much more should have been imparted to the grand jury under the control and auspices of County Attorney Mike Freeman. Didn't happen. Wasn't about to happen. We said that on these programs for many, many months. That, in fact, I have one of my columns in the Spokesman Recorder. I talked in terms. In fact, I laid out what one should expect if there was going to be fairness from the county attorney during the course of presenting the case to the grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a lot of that never happened, if you will. And now we began to get into a situation about how much information, by the way. I don't know that Mr. Patton is on top of this, but Mr. Patton supposedly is in discovery with the city.
Mm-hmm.
According to Mr. Patton in a conversation with this journalist this morning and last night, they were never informed that that gun had been in the custody or had the city had custodial control over that weapon, and that the city was going to make that weapon a part of the Terrence Franklin case. The rules of discovery are pretty stiff, you know.
Yes, they are.
Now, if you were a black attorney and you made that kind of mistake, you wouldn't be practicing no law no more. And I think that we are the first ones here on this program, the Donnie Ronnie program, that has raised the question on why Mr. Patton was not informed under the articles and rules of discovery that that weapon, quote-unquote, had come into the possession of the authorities and would ultimately be used to say that proved that Mr. Franklin, some way or another, was armed on the 10th day of May, 2013.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, pick it up, Mr. Allen. I have to make a battery change.
Okay, cool. I understand.
Go right ahead. Pick it up. Yeah.
Okay, got it. And then with that said, you know, we've reviewed, you know, this case several times, and like Mr. Edwards said, you can go back and look at our and listen to our other previous shows from last year where we dealt with this in depth, because this presents a really interesting challenge with the validity of the integrity of the Minneapolis Police Department, the city attorney's office, the county attorney, and also the political leaders here in this town. If a man who was actually unarmed at the time of him being surrounded by five police officers cannot be tased and put down, but comes out of a basement dead, there's a huge problem with that we need to address. You know, we saw marches here for Trayvon Martin, thousands of people. And in the meantime, we can't seem to get 10 or 15 people. And then when we do, you know, all they want to do is get in front of a camera or get quoted in the Star Tribune in this case. And we're seeing some of that same tomfoolery and fuckery, as I call it, again. So with that said, you know, it's something to really pay attention to here in the Twin Cities. And Mr. Edwards.
Mr. Allen, you're absolutely correct, sir. Go right ahead.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. I mean, I'm really troubled by this, and, you know, we haven't heard much of it, you know, since it happened. And, you know, there was no, and like you said, Mr. Edwards, October they found a weapon, and there wasn't a report by the Star and Tribune, but yet they used the Star and Tribune as a public relation arm of the Minneapolis Police Department.
Absolutely. The weapon was allegedly found by the resident of the home in which allegedly it was under the porch and wedged in between the porch and the foundation of the home. On the 28th day, it was immediately turned over to the BCA's crime laboratory, and it took them all that time to, quote-unquote, turn up the DNA.
We have a caller, too, when you...
So let's get them in. Go ahead.
Caller, you're live on the air, 9139. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Real good. What can we do for you, sir? What's your question?
All right. I just wanted to allude to something that Mr. Allen was just talking about in regards to organizing in Minneapolis. In keeping with that, he mentioned about the Trayvon Martin thing, how people got out and organized and, you know, went all out of their ways to bring attention to themselves to say that we're part of the effort. And I've noticed that that's been a pattern of Minneapolis, that they are quick to kiss the national ass of anybody, and they won't organize in their own community for things that are affecting them directly.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that over the years, it seems that they're always looking for somebody to come from the outside and give them the answer. You know, someone who comes here, speaks, gets a check, and moves on.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that none of the elected officials are working with the people here who are actually doing the work. I mean, just recently, I mean, I have nothing against Dr. Umar Johnson. I have nothing against some actress who Bobby Joe Champion felt like could come here and was the answer to the youth problem here. You know, she got a check and moved on as well. And I know I'm sounding like Mr. Edwards when I say this, but however, Minneapolis, more so than St. Paul, are so apt to kiss the national ass as opposed to organizing things that affect them directly. Like, case in point, you have stores in the communities that sell old food for higher prices. That sell cigarettes and blunts to underage people. You have these same stores and these owners of these stores who do not contribute not one nickel to your church, to any youth organization, any basketball league, or anything that would keep young people out of trouble, even in the height of, and you know, in the springtime, just before it gets summer, how a lot of young people are engaged in the same type of shooting, the same type of deal that goes on every summer. Nobody, none of these stores and these owners of these stores contribute to anybody here organizes to get these bloodsuckers out of the community or to at least raise conscience to other people as to not to even spend your money in a store where it says no exchange or refund, even if you have a receipt. And so, I just think that you were just so on point, Mr. Allen, when you how they're quick to organize because they're trendy. You know, these are wishy-washy, fair-weather people here in Minneapolis. And again, as I said before, and I'm going to say it again, they are so quick to kiss any national ass before they would organize right here and what affects them directly here at home in their communities. All of these things that are happening against them and their communities, but they'd rather run out and be mediatized, you know, to get, like you said, to get the name in the papers or to get the picture in the papers and that sort of thing as being down for the cause. But the cause is affecting you right here in your own community. And I'm going to shut up for a minute and listen to both of you gentlemen.
All right. Thank you.
I think, Mr. Allen,
let me just say this because I'm looking at our time and we've indicated another major story. And this would be probably a good place to segue based on what this last caller has said.
Yeah.
Because there is some examination going on about how our community is being facilitated for, and we need to move into that, Mr. Allen, and then hope, you know, we got enough time for any phone calls. Why don't you just start us off? Because we've got a serious situation in our community that everyone's trying to keep secret, and it just happened, yesterday morning, Mr. Allen?
Yeah, no, Monday. Monday.
What are we looking at here, and just how bad is it?
Well, we have to build the foundation for this real quick, Mr. Edwards. It started October 18th, 2013. There was a signal sent off by MenPost, who Judy Keene wrote a story, North Minneapolis still struggling to recover from 2011 tornado. That started a domino effect. That started to trigger some meetings here in town with some folks that we all know. Well, I'm going to jump here to this week. There's a meeting with some officials from CPED and some of our North Minneapolis community leaders, clergy, spokespersons, whatever you want to call them. And there is some serious concern about why there are still blue tarps on houses. Why is the property? And this also, let me add this, this also was triggered by Devin George wanting to do some development in that area west of Penn Avenue and Golden Valley Road, where their houses still sit today that are an apartment building that are vacant and torn up with holes in the roof and everything. Now, let me just get back to this because I really need to read this also. This is a very important piece. If you remember the tornado, you had the NCRT led by Lewis King from Summit Academy OIC and also Reverend Coleman, who was with Sanctuary CDC. CDC was...
Yes, Reverend
community.
Coleman, yes.
Reverend
formerly
Coleman.
Of Kingdom Oil, formerly of Kingdom
yes.
Oil. Why, certainly.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yes. And you know, I had inquired many times to the Minneapolis Foundation to find out exactly what happened with some of the money, okay? And a balance sheet provided by Reverend Coleman shows cash on hand was $470.78. However, the balance sheet accounts for only $160,000 of at least $395,000 the NCRT received from Minneapolis Helps Fund. The foundation says A final report is expected this summer. This summer.
Give us that date again when you say this summer. Give us that date again, Mr. Allen.
Okay. This was actually written October 18th, 2013, just last quarter, okay?
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, again, it says, however, the balance sheet only accounts for $668,000 of at least $395,000 the NCRT received from Minneapolis Health Fund. The foundation says the final report is expected later this summer, which obviously is the summer of 2014. Now, this brings a whole, this opens up a can of worms for some people because, you know, you have Salem Inc., which is Reverend Jerry McAfee's construction company that had, you know, his little logo out across North Minneapolis. You had Urban Homeworks doing some insurance work. You had a couple other folks out here in the community doing insurance work, and you had
people. Well, let me give you let's get, because we know how, you know, we are questioned about the authenticity of these things. Let us talk in terms of the organization known as We Care, which came out with a number of brochures. In fact, Star Tribune wrote some critical analysis of them and then kind of withdrew. Their motto was need help with emergency services, and these were a whole group of construction companies, Mr. Allen, that you and I heard discussions about in June, July, and August of 2011 that were going to come in and work on these houses and get our people back into their houses that had been damaged and et cetera. Now, this list was made available. It is a classified list for reasons of request by Thor Construction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, they had a trailer set up right there on Broadway and Penn, in which they were having people come in. People were being referred there by the Northside Emergency Fund. So that's an organization that you, I do believe, has come up because you said insurance, and see, they were doing insurance certification.
Yeah.
Okay. And they had, you know, they were requesting a copy of trade license, copy of current certification, MBE, WMBE, VBE, letter from insurance agents stating insurance qualifications and et cetera. We have to push some of this in because it goes to what Mr. Allen is talking about at this point, that there was money paid out. Significant amounts of money. In fact, we have out of the files a communique sent by the Minneapolis Foundation and the Greater United Way, in mm-hmm. which they indicated in a 14-day period, major white corporations in this city provided $780,000 to these Northside organizations.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
Well, it ultimately went to $1 million. And just for folks that, you know, want to question what happened, I am referring from the confidential files of the National Research Group in California. The Minneapolis Foundation, Greater Twin Cities United Way, Minnesota Helps, North Minneapolis Recovery Fund. Status update, June 3rd, 2011. How much has been raised? Oops, $780,000. And let me just give the list of Minnesota corporations that came up with this money within 14 days. Best Buy Corporation, Comcast, the George Family Foundation, the Gretel Foundation, Park Nicollet Foundation, the St. Paul Foundation, TCF Foundation, U.S. Bank, Private Client and Trust Services Foundation, and Wells Fargo Foundation.
Mm.
These were the immediate contributors. Now, what Mr. Allen is laying out is that on yesterday morning, a meeting was called by the county. The county was involved. The city of Minneapolis. The attorney general's office had representatives there. University of Minnesota and others. I didn't know that these folks had gotten so much money from all of these different entities. Now, we are being told, and we know the air can be clear. Come on, Mr. Allen. I mean, you there on the right, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
We're being told that some of our leaders and their organizations could not produce receipts for the monies they said they spent. Now, is that correct, Mr. Allen?
That is what the sources are telling us, that several of the folks in our community, some people that look like us, received dollars and cannot produce receipts. But furthermore, some of them, a select few, had properties, rental properties in North Minneapolis that we are working to get some information answered on how they got these properties in the first place, but had their properties alone worked on it. Now, Mr. Edwards, I got to bring you back to something. You remember right after the tornado, we were kind of hard on the Minneapolis Urban League because they said they didn't have anywhere to put anybody.
Yes.
And then later we found out they had a group home not too far from the Urban League that was...
They're on Morgan.
Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
That was empty the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we find that pretty, you know, disingenuous by Scott Gray and the members of the Minneapolis Urban League, who we never know when meetings are, kind of like the NAACP here in Minneapolis. But, you know, you have little things like that going on, and then you have, like, the insurance game. I mean, there's people, navigators, going door-to-door trying to find out if people had insurance, and then referred them back to the trailer and contractors that could work.
Back to
on
We
insurance.
Care was the ordinary.
Back to, yeah, back to
yeah.
We care. We care about that money. You know, but see, and you know, Mr. Edwards, I was actually, how can I put this? I was kicked out of the meeting because I was asking questions on August 10th, 2011. I was.
Now, let me just say this, Mr. Allen, about how things were run, military style, if you will. There was a woman. Name is Cisa Guerra or Cisa, who was trespassed by my brother Louis King because she was photographing some of the confrontations that were going on and some of the disrespect being shown to the residents of the victims of the tornado. Her last name is it Ishigari?
Yeah, Cherry
Japanese.
Ishigari. No,
yeah, okay,
good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, actually, she was expelled before you were. But Mr. Allen was told that he had to depart, and he had to depart then. Let me just also say this, because we have about 12 minutes left. I want to make sure. A couple of years ago on these programs, we indicated, and, of course, we were chided and made fun of and et cetera, that I have had in my possession a secret communique that went to some of my leaders, and it, let me just do this for them, Don. This communique was sent at approximately 3 p.m. on 5/26/2011, and the purpose of the communique was to indicate how the Northside Community Response Team was going to be put together. And they designated who would head up everything from communication, organizational needs assessment, human needs, even brush removal and patching and scrubbing. That's where they started getting involved in the We Care. Now, to have seen this kind of elaborate planning go on to put people in position, and then to see apparently the anger that was displayed, according to government sources, yesterday morning when folks were confronted about the fact that they had took money that was intended for the people and took care of their personal properties, rental properties, and et cetera, took care of their church and et cetera there, which did not come close to being touched by the tornado, if you will. Mm-hmm. These kinds of allegations, you know, do not serve us well. And Don, I just have to say from the left, I know there's an explanation. Now, my understanding is that the city of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, the U.S. State Attorney's Office, and et cetera, have given our leaders – a time certain? Oh, that's right. The drop dead date, though, is like, is it in April 1st? Because doesn't all this have to be taken care of within a 3-year window?
Yes, yes. This has to be squared away here pretty quick and packed away and unbundled and bundled up because, you know, this report this summer, you know, I don't know what they meant by this summer, and I probably need to send that writer, that columnist an email, but, you know, this was
well, this summer would, this coming summer would be the drop dead
yeah.
date when everything commenced. Again, I, you know, for our detractors and et cetera, we would caution you to be very careful with any kind of denunciation in light of the status update report of June 3rd, 2011, and particularly given the major Minnesota corporations / foundations who, as we said before, I mean, the figure's right there. In fact, the opening line on the letter says, thanks to the generosity of the community, $780,000 has been raised in 2 weeks. And as my colleague, Mr. Allen, said, it went specifically to a combination of organizations which later became the RRTCP or whatever it is, if you will. There was one tragedy in this, though, Mr. Allen, and
yeah.
I'm understanding that it was this organization's information that was used to try to falsify the quote-unquote payouts, if you will, and that there was an organization, and particularly for those that are there from the Star Tribune and et cetera, there's an organization called Elam.
Uh-huh.
And they were a very respected and organization, Transitional Housing. They're the ones that Mr. Allen and I watched paid the bills for many of our residents who were forced out of their homes and et cetera to stay in hotels and et cetera. And it looks like a couple of our leadership organizations took the information from Elam, who was forced out of business by the county, and took that information and registered Mr. Allen. Now, if I'm incorrect, correct me, please, because I know that you have talked, you've reached out to one of the chief investigators. They got caught using the information from Elam, but they thought
yes.
that they were safe because Elam had been forced under. Is that correct? Am I
that
correct,
correct
in stating
yes.
that from the left?
You are correct from the left, but not only Elam, Mr. Edwards, the Lutheran organization that did the PowerPoint presentation that dealt with disaster. They're
yes.
on Park Avenue. Yeah, you know, they lifted some of their PowerPoint. And
Oh my.
They were
that
using
was
that
the organization that put together the meeting that morning. To indicate that they were bringing in emergency help. That's when the Salvation Army, the Red Cross, and others. And then that afternoon, we had the meeting of, quote-unquote, the new players who just took control away from. In fact, it's one of the reasons that the Salvation Army, by June the 20th, if I'm not mistaken, said they couldn't have any more to do with this effort and they would go it alone because they saw what was happening. You know, oh, let me say this also for our friends out there. These folks also made a nice killing. Maybe that's a poor choice of words. Made a nice haul in dealing with, and I'm looking at the committee identified as the Subcommittee on Mental and Chemical Health. You remember that, don't you, Mr. Allen? They
yeah.
picked up $200,000.
Yeah. Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
I think I made a motion. I mean, didn't I make the motion for them? I did. I made the motion for them to get the money. And it passed right through. No one said anything.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. That's right. Initially, they were over at the Urban League and then kind of went across the street to our UROC, University of Minnesota, started raising questions about the distribution of the money and also was cutting into the plan that Dr. Cicchetti had to deal with the health problems of the African-American. And they wound up at North Point. You know, but like I said, just for anybody that wants to challenge, we got the outline, you know, the subcommittee on mental and chemical health, if you will. Boy,
we do have another caller, by the way.
Oh, let's get the caller. Yeah.
Caller, you are live on the air.
Yeah, I'm back. I just wanted to say that I heard that list of people that you said that made significant contributions to the upbringing and redevelopment of the North Side.
They responded immediately to the conditions imposed by the tornado.
Okay.
And they immediately delivered $780,000 to a entity called Minnesota Helps / North Minneapolis Recovery Fund, which out of that came the quote-unquote the organization that was to disperse the money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I understand that. My point is that the very stores who live off of the community that was affected mostly by the tornado are people who did not contribute a dime to the development, the redevelopment of that community. I also just wanted to say that, and that's something that people won't organize against. These sheeple here, they just sit around and they watch. The information that you're giving us now in regards to the so-called, well, leaders, there is no black leadership in Minneapolis as far as I'm concerned, because with the last election, I've been here for about 25 years, mm-hmm. and the last election showed me that black Minneapolis has been slapped back for 20 years. They have nothing at all. So there is no leadership. Because if so, where has it led us to? Because we're 20 years behind now. Last election proves that.
Absolutely. First time in 33 years that there is no African-American on the city council in Minneapolis. First time in 27 years there's no African-American on the city council in St. Paul. We have to go hat in hand now to City Hall to even
Thank
be
you.
Admitted through the doors. We cannot even get meetings with representatives, and particularly the wards where there's a heavy concentration of African-Americans, both in North and South Minneapolis. Now, it's an interesting point. No one wants to address it, though. They don't want to touch it.
Thank you so much for that confirmation, because I thought I was the only one, and that was the same thing I said. Now you got Negroes running around, you know, just waiting for either scraps to drop off of the big man's table, off the master's table, or they're begging to be thrown something or see what will fall off. I also say that those people, those culprits who misrepresented the community as far as that money was concerned and everything, I feel that they should be arrested. They should be put in jail. They should be put
in
jail.
Let me say this, sir, as we near the end of our program. That's kind of what was told to them yesterday morning. Am I correct, Mr. Allen?
Yes,
that there could be significant legal action, including the seizing and freezing of their funds.
Mm-hmm.
Expose them devils and lock mm-hmm. them up, because they deceive the community. And what they have done was they have helped to perpetuate the stealing of the souls and the blood of a community that was already being sucked by everything else. And as we know, there's somebody who's buying everything over there now, and the complexion has changed. You know, I hear some people talking that Northside for Life stuff. My opinion is, if you don't own a home, you got about another 9 months before your lease is up, and you'll be in
Coon
Rapids.
That's right.
It's like the rest of them people talking that Northside for Life stuff. And so I appreciate what you gentlemen do in terms of bringing information, because it's bold. It's very bold, and there's a lot of people who want to sweep that under the carpet. They don't want to just face up to themselves. These sheeple here in Minneapolis have lost. They lost because I'm one of those people who migrated here, but I migrated here from Chicago about 25 years ago, along with people from Milwaukee, Kansas City, and was being told by black people to go back there. They said nothing to these other ethnic groups who have came here, opened up stores, did all of this. And so-called black people here are saying to us, we don't need to do anything. See, because it took the Koreans and all of those other people to come here to show the people who were from here that they were still niggas. They didn't think that at first, you know. They didn't think that at first. But it took for them Koreans and all these other people to come here and show them that they're niggas. And now they're saying, we need to do this. I look at them and say, nigga, we don't need to do nothing. I did just like the rest of the people who you told to go back to wherever they came from. I went and bought a house in the suburbs and let you handle this here. And now you got nothing.
Okay. Right. Well, thank you, my brother. Appreciate it. Mr. Allen, very quickly, I know we got about 45, 50 seconds. Let me read you a press release dated July 6, 2011 from the Minneapolis Foundation, the United Way. Minnesota Helps Fund grants $500,000 to launch a coordinated recovery effort in North Minneapolis. You and I know who got all that money, don't we, my brother?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we do.
This is a press release for those out there. When you go back to talk and speak to Master and tell and wiggle your tongue, that this was a press release put out within the white media by the Minneapolis Foundation and the United Way. Again, it's dated July 6, 2011. That's when they told y'all that we're getting over there at OIC, $500,000 is going to be put in your hands. Take care, Mr. Allen.
Thank you.